Madame Tussauds and the French Revolution, The Great Necklace Scandal, Part 2. Now, last time we talked about how the scandal started. Now we're going to have the part where the necklace is actually going to change hands. And then next time, it did not prove difficult for Madame de Lamotte to involve Cardinal Rohan. He was completely isolated from Marie Antoinette's personal circle, and he knew only a few of the ladies who enjoyed her confidence. When Madame de Lamotte brought him the first series of notes in what he believed was the Queen's own hand, and signed Marie Antoinette, he was delighted, and wrote passionately grateful replies. Only once during the drawn-out negotiations did the Cardinal's confidence actually waver. He could not simply understand, he told Madame de Lamotte, why the Queen, when she wrote him so graciously, gave not the slightest sign of recognizing him in public. Madame de Lamotte promised to tell the Queen of his great wish for some sign from her. In due course, the lady informed him that Marie Antoinette felt it might arouse some inconvenient comment about their new relationship if she acknowledged him publicly. But she would meet him in the dark in one of the groves of Versailles Park for a brief rendezvous. Then she would give him a token of her friendship and gratitude. The Cardinal, whose common sense had clearly deserted him in his joy, becoming on good terms with the Queen, was only too eager to comply. It was easy for Madame de Lamotte and her equally unscrupulous husband to arrange such a rendezvous. The palace gardens were, of course, open to all, and I would point out they still are. And the Queen's pleasure was in taking late-night strolls in the fresh air, and that was well known. All the conspiring couple had to do was to find a suitable young woman to impersonate Marie Antoinette, and they already knew one. As courteous and Marie realized, the Palais Royal gardens were becoming increasingly disreputable and frequented by many prostitutes. There was one such girl they both knew by sight and remarked on because in profile in particular, she had a remarkable likeness to the Queen, and there was a similarity of height and figure. If not seeking a client immediately, this girl often strolled or sat in the gardens accompanied by her landlady's little boy. Madame de Lamotte, who often promenaded in the garden herself, had noticed this girl and knew her name, Lugue d'Olivia. She was a simple soul and easily persuaded by the richly dressed lady who approached her to play a part in a charade, for good payment, of course. On the night arranged with the Cardinal, Mademoiselle d'Olivia, cloaked and with her head swathed in a lace shawl, was stationed in a dark grove not far from the palace at Versailles. A rose was placed in her hand, and she was to hand it to the gentleman who would approach her. It was too dark to see any features. When the Cardinal, dressed in ordinary attire and taken to the rendezvous by Madame de Lamotte, came towards Mademoiselle d'Olivia and bowed deeply, she handed over the flower as instructed, a gift that seemed to be received with great emotion. Then she quickly turned away into the trees as she had been told. Cardinal Rohan was convinced that he had indeed had a brief encounter with Marie Antoinette. Though he could not recognize the features in the dark, the figure of the cloaked lady resembled that of Marie Antoinette. Negotiations about the diamond necklace could now be completed. The relieved jeweler, Bulmer, drew up a contract. Payment for the jewels would be made in installments. After Cardinal Rohan had read the document, Madame de Lamotte took it, saying that it must be approved by the Queen before the necklace was handed over. She brought it back to Cardinal Rohan with each clause signed, Marie Antoinette de France. All was now in order for the delivery of the necklace, which said Madame de Lamotte would be effected in a house she owned in Versailles. There the Cardinal himself could hand it over to a special messenger sent by the Queen. The Cardinal, incognito, and again dressed in non-clerical garb, drove to the house in Versailles indicated by Madame de Lamotte, carrying the necklace in its great velvet-lined case. Not letting it out of his hands, he was received by Madame de Lamotte. They waited a short time in the luxuriously furnished salon. Then the door opened, and a man dressed in black stood there silently. "This is the Queen's personal messenger," said Madame de Lamotte. "Hand him the case." The Cardinal obeyed, and the man departed without saying a word. Cardinal Rohan then drove back to Paris, content that Marie Antoinette had achieved her desire and that the brilliant ornament was safely lodged in her personal jewelry collection. In fact, Bohmer's famous work was never seen again. Madame de Lamont's husband took it straight to England, where it was broken up and all the diamonds sold. Now, of course, at this time, Marie Antoinette knows nothing about what's going on. Louis XVI knows nothing about what's going on. But, of course, the jeweler is going to be part of the problem, because the jeweler was selected to make a buckle and shoulder ornament and diamonds for Marie Antoinette. You know, Louis XVI was going to give it to her. And when he arrives at the court, he then hands a folded piece of paper and a note for the queen. And that's when she gets the first indication that something has gone very badly wrong. So next time, we will see what happens at the end of the diamond affair. Now, the sources for this: Madame Tussaud, A Life in Wax by Berridge. Madame Tussaud, Her Life and Legacy by Walton. Waxing Methodical, Life and Legend of Madame Tussaud by Berridge, and The French Revolution as Seen Through the Eyes of Madame Tussaud by Chapman. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.